You're listening to the Nightlife Podcast with Indira Naidu.
They're very, very tough times indeed for the restaurant industry at the moment, not only in Australia, but worldwide. The coronavirus pandemic has meant many thousands of jobs have gone, while restaurants have been either forced to shut or to greatly reduce their output, with fine dining establishments joining small local food outlets by offering takeaway only. Well, tonight, someone who can give us an insight into one of the most intense and competitive restaurant scenes in the world, that of New York. 8 years ago, at the tender age of 21, Victoria James achieved her dream job. She became America's youngest sommelier at a Michelin-starred restaurant. She's since worked in several New York City's most lavish dining establishments, taking on the role of restaurateur and achieving many successes. But she has also faced bullying, abuse, and even sexual assault, as well as tough financial times. She's now written of her experiences in a new book, simply called Wine Girl, and Victoria joins us from New York City. Welcome to Nightlife, Victoria.
Thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Well, first, can I ask you, what's it like being in New York at the moment?
Well, it's just morning here. It's around 7 a.m. and the streets are quiet. The eerie thing is that as the day progresses, it kind of stays at the same level of very mellow and only a few cars on the streets.
And are the restaurants opened or are they shuttered up?
So our restaurant is open for delivery and takeout, but many unfortunately have had to shutter completely during this time. It's very alarming.
Yeah, it just must be extraordinary. As someone who visits New York quite often and just used to that hum and the bustle, it just must be so eerie for you at the moment. Now, to your book, it opens with you presenting a very valuable wine as a nervous young sommelier to a group of four suited businessmen. Tell me what happens.
So I was 21 years old and the youngest sommelier in the country at the time. And this group of men orders a $650 bottle of Chardonnay mm-hmm. on a Monday lunch, no less. And the bottle was amazing and fantastic. And I tasted it and it was completely sound. However, the gentleman at the table wanted to send the bottle back. And they said that I probably had too much perfume in my nose. And was there anything worse than having a female as a sommelier that I couldn't tell the wine was corked? Hmm. And working in fine dining in New York as well, there's immense pressure to meet these unattainably low costs. So I knew that we couldn't return the bottle to our vendors, that we would never get credit, that my beverage director would be furious. And so I had to think quickly about a solution that would make everyone happy. And so I ran to the cellar and presented the guests with a fresh bottle of wine. However, I served them the original bottle. Uh-huh. And the gentleman decided that it was the best bottle of wine he's ever had. And it was amazing. And thank God that I brought him a fresh bottle. And he went on to insult me and, you know, essentially every woman in the human race. But, I think it just sort of illustrated the fact that women at times in their professions can be incredibly competent, and yet they're constantly being thwarted and second guessed.
And as you outline in your book, this happens a number of times throughout your career, not only as a sommelier, but just generally in the restaurant industry. Before we move on to that, Victoria, I want to ask you about your upbringing first, because you detail some pretty tough experiences in your upbringing. You moved house a lot. Your parents were often fighting. Your mother battled depression. Your father was often a drunk and also a gambler. What did that do to you and your spirit?
Well, I think that it taught me a sort of resilience and how to take a bad situation and find the good. And it certainly gave me a sense of independence, which was quite helpful later on. But at the same time, too, it took me a while to break free from a lot of negative patterns and feelings of isolation and insecurity. I think it gave me a lot of tools for my future, but also hindered me in quite a few ways as well.
And you also had a brush with drugs as well?
Correct, yeah. So when I was just getting into restaurants in my teenage years, and I loved being around people and the environment of hospitality, I was unfortunately sexually assaulted by a customer, and it just really broke me. And after that, and not feeling like I had anyone to go to or parents to go to, I spiraled into drugs and depression, and eventually got a DUI in California and came home and just sort of realized that I needed to find something with purpose in my life. And it was actually my little sister that healed me and gave me that sense of purpose and gave me a sense of self.
Mm. And your book, and you detail, you know, all these dips and troughs and climbs that you've had throughout your life and in your career. It's beautifully written. You could have easily gone into writing, into poetry, rather than into the wine industry. Did you ever consider that?
Thank you. That's very kind. I've always kept diaries since I was a kid, which was quite helpful when writing memoirs. Often wrote down little poems and such. It was sort of a way to express my emotions. I don't know if I would have gone into poetry instead of wine. I love people and I love serving others, so that was certainly my calling.
Well, there is something poetic about good wine, isn't there? And I'm interested in the name you gave the book, The Wine Girl, you called it. Now, there's a story behind why you called it that.
Yeah, so it was sort of, I decided to reclaim that title. It was something that was used as a slur towards me my entire career. Guests and even bosses would use it towards me. Something like, oh, here's the wine girl. I guess they only send over the real sommelier when you order real wine. And wine girl, would you like to come over to my cellar and see all the fancy bottles I have? Or wine girl, come sit on my lap. And, you know, it was sort of this derogatory slur that really dug at me over time, because none of the men sommeliers were ever called wine boy, and no one would dare use this term towards them. And so I decided that I would sort of reclaim that name and use it as the title of my book.
So what made you first fall in love with wine, with alcohol and cocktail making and the craft and art behind it?
Well, I certainly didn't grow up in that environment. My parents don't drink wine at all. And when bartending during college and university, I quickly realized that I had no knowledge of wine whatsoever. So I picked up a book, Wine for Dummies, and quickly was hooked. There's something so fascinating about wine, because each bottle not only holds a story about centuries of tradition and people and places, but it also combined all of the loves I had for hospitality and travel and people and reading. And it just hooked me right away. And then I later realized wine was a further tool in hospitality, a way I could connect with guests even more so. And who doesn't want to, you know, drink and serve wine for a living?
Yeah, no, sounds pretty good to me. You mentioned then that, you know, you loved serving people, and I understand that that was quite a large part of your childhood. You did spend a lot of time setting up lemonade stands and you know, serving friends and guests, and then you worked at Greasy Spoons. Tell us about Frankie and his particular advice to you.
So at a Greasy Spoon diner when I was a teenager, there was a gentleman who worked there named Frankie. He was one of the servers, and his advice to me was find a way to love everyone. And it was something he called the love cycle. And it wasn't as if you would look for, you would look at someone and you would think, oh, I love their dress. What you were looking for is their sense of humanity, and find out who they really are and love them for it. And it gives you purpose over time. It gives you fulfillment. And in turn, by making people happy, it made me happy as well. And it's this continual cycle that's quite fulfilling. You show love to others and they show you love back.
And this is what you brought to your work as a sommelier. What do you think makes you a good sommelier?
I think a good sommelier is one that cares about their guests. And again, you know, wine is just sort of the vehicle for hospitality. So, you know, I think one mistake a lot of sommeliers make is that they use sort of, they lean on their snobbery,
yes,
perhaps all of this intelligence they've acquired, which no doubt is incredibly difficult, of course, but that further isolates you and it puts you on a little island all by yourself. And that's not really a great way to connect with people. And that's what being a human is all about, connecting with other people. And that's the beauty of wine.
And you say a sommelier must taste every single bottle before serving and that the customer is also expected to do that as well. How is this and why has this ritual developed?
Yeah, it's a hard job, tasting every bottle. So, you know, I actually really love the pageantry of this. And I know that it sometimes is confusing for a lot of guests. They don't understand why they have to taste it, if the sommelier has already tasted it, or they're not quite sure what to do. And essentially what it is it's a ritual that's developed over time. It's the sommelier putting their expertise on the back burner and saying, yes, I've already tasted this wine. The wine is already fine, but I'm presenting it to you as if I'm bowing down to you and showing you my respect. And then hopefully in turn, the guest bows down and shows their respect as well. So I actually think it's quite lovely. And it's something I continue to do all the time in the restaurant because I just think it's such a beautiful way to show your respect for one another.
And do you find that many people return bottles of wine?
No, it happens very rarely. Usually preferences are established beforehand.
Yeah. And the other thing I've always been fascinated about is there a difference between men and women and their palates and the way they taste? Have you come across that in your work?
Well, I'm not a doctor, so I can't say for sure. But what I will say is that, as a woman, I certainly think I taste differently than a lot of my male colleagues. I don't know what the science behind that is, but I think it's also a lot of nature versus nurture. And we're certainly, there's so few female sommeliers that I work with or that are in my field. And so I think we're constantly pushed to be better and better. And we taste more at times. And so I think that often when you're at odds or you're on the margins of a society, you push yourself harder. And I don't know if it has anything to do with a better palate, but in my experience, it means that I've certainly tasted quite a bit of wines.
Okay. So maybe a different palate, if not a better one.
I can't say for sure, but I would like to think so.
And the other thing, Victoria, you describe how you've poured wine for so many, you know, rich and famous clients over the years at the various high-end restaurants that you've worked at and run, including Mick Fleetwood, Miley Cyrus, and Mariah Carey. And this story I found really hilarious, that Mariah Carey forced the staff at one of your restaurants to play her Christmas album on repeat for the whole night. Tell me about that.
So it was right before Christmas, and we had a staff party planned later that evening at a local pub. But she actually came up to the restaurant last minute. She was hours late for her reservation. And so, of course, our Christmas party was ruined. But she had her own little party at the restaurant and instructed us all to play her Christmas album on repeat, which I think is only a few songs. So now I still have flashbacks whenever it comes on. And
let me give you another flashback.
Oh no.
I don't want a lot for Christmas. I don't care about the presents underneath the Christmas tree. I just want you for my own, more than you could ever know. wish come true. All I want for Christmas is you.
I mean,
sorry about that.
Incredible.
I couldn't resist. Yes.
She's fabulous.
Yeah, of course. And that song's actually come back and been another hit for her again. So incredible. But it just shows that you have to deal with all sorts of clientele, don't you, in your work? Be very tactful as well.
Yes.
Now, you're still young, but you write in your book that you hope your story will give young women all over the world courage to share their stories and take charge of their lives and empower others. Just how tough do you think it still is for young women in the food and wine world in the US now?
Well, now I'm in a position of power and I can actually make a difference in the community, which is so important to me. But it's still quite hard for women. And it's one of the reasons I decided to co-found a nonprofit called Wine Empowered, which offers tuition-free wine classes to women and persons of color in the industry. And it most importantly creates this sense of community, the sense of belonging, a safe place where women are not sexualized or belittled. And it's right now, I think women more so than ever need allies, and they need people that say, you know, we'll protect you and we will give you a place where you can grow and build your career. So it's getting better, but there's still a lot of work to do.
You're listening to Nightlife with Indira Naidu, and we're speaking with Victoria James, sommelier, restaurateur, author, about her memoir, Wine Girl. Victoria, you were telling us about the Wine Empowered group that you set up. What was the reaction to men in the industry when they heard about it?
So it's really wonderful, actually, that we have so many fantastic male allies. And the group is also open to any person of color. So, of course, that includes men as well, essentially persons that were at one time marginalized in the wine world. We believe that the more diverse voices that are brought to the table, the more innovation that can occur. And we have so many great white male allies and friends that are supportive, and they helped us by sending recommendations for women and persons of color for the class. They helped sponsor wine and sent donations. So it's really wonderful that there are so many supportive men as well that realize the importance of this cause.
Yeah, well, that's good to hear. Now, there's a lot of snobbery. You did mention it earlier around wine. Do you personally, what are some of the best wines that you've sampled in your career? Do they tend to be ones that have a high price tag associated with them as well?
So there are certainly many incredible bottles that are quite pricey, but I've tasted so many wines, and I really do believe there can be just as much joy in a $20 bottle as there can be in a $2,000 bottle. It all depends on who you share it with. Mm. The reason some of these wines are so expensive is not because they're the best ever, but because of supply and demand, and because there's so little of it made. And some of them certainly justify the price tag. And, you know, a lot of these winemakers who are making these fancy bottles are not necessarily raking in the profits. They probably have minuscule outputs and are only making wine in such small quantities. And in order to make a living, they have to just make more expensive bottles.
Mm. So do you have a couple of favorites that you've, you know, still remember?
Well, there was this one bottle I served, a 1947 Cheval Blanc from Bordeaux, which was quite pricey, but...
How expensive?
I'm not sure what the conversion rate was at the time, but it was $45,000.
Oh, gosh.
For a bottle.
Wow. All right.
Yes.
And who ordered that?
It was the wonderful, amazing Padma Lakshmi. She is...
the chef, the Indian...
Yes, exactly. Yes. She's a chef.
Wow.
And I hope she loved it. I think she did.
Extraordinary. Now, obviously, because sommeliers get to taste the wine before they serve it, you got to taste it, right?
Yes, I got a small 1 ounce taste. And, you know, the bottle's expensive because it's so old and there's just not many bottles left of it in the world. And it was a historical vintage and time and place. And there's this lore that goes around the story that the winemaker had a fight with his wife that year. And so she kicked him out of the house and made him sleep in the vineyards. And because he slept in the vineyards tending to the grapes every single night, the produce was remarkable.
Wow. And what do you think of Aussie wines, Victoria?
There are some fantastic ones. I have had a lot of sommelier friends that have lived there and worked in Australia and said that it's probably one of the best New World wine regions. And there's so many exciting, cool new things happening there. Lots of innovation. So, you know, big fan.
Okay, we've got a call now from Nicholas in Geelong that I'll take. Hello, Nicholas. How are you?
Look, really enjoying the conversation. You've beat me to the punch there, Indira. I was going to ask, well, two issues. One, I was going to ask, I'm really amazed at how much good wine Australians can produce at such a low price. There's some very good wines at very reasonably priced bottles. That was the first thing. The second thing I'd like to throw up for debate is that I attended a wine masterclass quite a few years ago, and all the wines I really loved and marked, you know, top of my list, the two women I was with hated, and they were both very knowledgeable on wines, and the wines that they loved, I thought were really bland and unappealing, and it led me to think, this is just an idea that I have, but because women watch what they eat when they're nursing and feeding infants, and if they eat something that's poisonous or overly bitter or something, it could affect their children, I do think that there may be a biological difference in the palate of men and women. So that's just a point I'd like to throw open for debate.
Okay. Well, Victoria, we did mention this before, and you have noticed there are differences, but you don't particularly think it falls along the gender lines?
Well, that's a great point. Thank you for bringing that up, and thank you for calling in. I have read so many different studies that doctors have done, and I think it's fascinating. I think that maybe we should continue to do some more studies, but there's just not conclusive evidence yet. So I think it's hard to say, but I think it's definitely a very interesting point and one which we could do some more tests on for sure. Okay. And yes, there's so many fabulous Australian wines.
All right, Nicholas, thanks a lot for your call. And we've got another call here, Victoria, that I'll take from Anne in South Coogee. Hello, Anne. How are you?
Hi, Indira and Victoria. I want to tell you a great and sad story of Australian wine.
Mm-hmm.
The best wine I ever tasted was a St. Augustine Chardonnay 1996 at the Vineyard. Unfortunately, it was bought up by a giant cooperative and they just do the regional grapes now. But I later found out that wine was first made by Dr. Frascati, who thought that in the 1870s, wine was a better sedative than all the lotions and potions that they used at Sydney Hospital. And he went up to Mudgee and established that vineyard, and the motif was the pig, and the pig is the pig that's outside Sydney Hospital. It used to be a coin-throwing water fountain.
There you go.
Now, we've destroyed our history, and no one knows that history, but he was actually one of the first big winemakers in Australia, and we just let that vineyard go to rack and ruin.
Right. Well, Anne, thank you very much for that piece of history. I've always wondered about that. We've got a very famous fountain outside our hospital in Sydney, and Anne was just talking about the origins of that. So it's quite interesting, some of these stories that come up. Victoria, if I can ask you, you went on from your sommelier work to operating restaurants as well. How and why did the switch come about?
So I love beverage and wine, and I was working as a sommelier at a 2-Michelin-starred restaurant, and then from there progressed to a wine buyer, which is kind of a step up from a sommelier. You're not only selling wine, but you're also purchasing the wine for the wine list. And that was sort of where I figured out I had a completely different passion as well, where I could support these small growers and like Anne, who just called in, you know, sort of preserve these stories and then these little guys, and really champion for them and these farmers. And so, and that's what I do now. So at our restaurant, Coke Korean Steakhouse in New York, I'm the beverage director and buy all the wine and water and spirits for the program. But I'm also a partner in the restaurant as well. So see everyday operations and hiring and such. And it's sort of a more holistic way, and quite fulfilling as well.
And what's happened to that restaurant, Victoria, in the current climate?
It's certainly a challenging time. We have been mandated to close for dine-in service, but we are still doing delivery and to-go. We are actually selling wine from the restaurant, as well as spirits. And it's just interesting. I now feel like I'm running a wine shop. We're selling lots of wine, which is great. People are drinking during the pandemic.
One of the things that I've noticed is all these extraordinary high-end restaurants have set up tables in front of the restaurants with their wine cellars on display on the footpath and selling them at below, you know, markets and rates. And it's really plays with your head what we're seeing now.
Well, you know, people who work in restaurants are some of the most resilient and scrappy people out there, and they will come up with all sorts of ideas to make ends meet and provide for their employees and their guests as well. It's still such an honor that we're able to serve our guests.
Mm. And I guess they're used to margins being really tight, aren't they? They're used to just having to adapt and rejig, and that's what they're trying to do at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't know that with restaurants, you know, 90% of what comes in usually is not profit. It's a very hard business. And during these times as well, it can be even trickier. So it's hard to change your business model overnight, but it's what a lot have been forced to do in order to survive.
Now, it's not probably relevant right at the moment because so many restaurants have closed, but a big part of your book describes how restaurants have to deal with critics, often living in fear of a bad review. Tell us about the power of food critics in New York City.
Yeah, so in New York City, there are a few critics that really can make it or break a restaurant. And the one big one is the writer for the New York Times. And a lot of my friends who are actors will say that it's similar to when you open a play. You know, one review could mean everything. And so as a result, those behind the scenes at restaurants go through intense training and learn how to spot critics. And they have pages and pages of notes of what they look like, dining companions they've come in with recently to other restaurants. They have a whole database of information. And hopefully, with this information, when you're equipped with it, you can try and get a better review, though, as you'll see in the book, not always the case.
And do they try to disguise themselves?
Sometimes, you know, there was a very famous critic who's no longer the critic for the Times, but Ruth Reichel.
Oh, yes.
And she used to have elaborate costumes, which if I were a critic, I would totally do. It sounds so much fun.
And often when you wear an elaborate costume, that's when people can pick you out, can't they? Why is she wearing big black sunglasses inside?
Yes, or big fancy hats.
And so what do you find when a critic likes your restaurant, okay, do you find that that then really does have an effect on the numbers of people that will come and dine at the restaurant?
Yes, absolutely. So we're so fortunate that at Coat, our restaurant now, we were welcomed warmly by the critics and got rave reviews. And it was astonishing to see almost overnight everything changed. We still continue to have a month-long waiting list, and we got a Michelin star. And so all of these things are really actually quite important, and the critics still do matter.
And what do you think will happen now to restaurant critics? Obviously, they've all lost their jobs. I mean, what will they actually do?
Well, it's funny, actually. One restaurant critic for the New Yorker magazine, she had us send her food to go since we're doing food and delivery options. And so she just wrote about it in this week's episode of the New Yorker dining column. And it's interesting, maybe critics will evolve to critiquing delivery food or to-go food.
Really?
Maybe. That's what's happening already. So we'll see. But I think more so than anything, critics have always been, they're not really critiquing a restaurant. They're critiquing the culture and the community. And they're like gardeners, and they're tending to this garden and deciding who are the weeds and who are the flowers and who will help the whole ecosystem flourish. And so they're commenting on what's happening now in the dining culture. And right now the culture is to go.
Right. Fair enough. And so, Victoria, when you when the virus hit and caused all this upheaval in the restaurant industry in New York City, was there literally one moment where you realized, oh, this everything was going to change in the next couple of hours? We were going to have to keep on staff, sack staff, close the business. How much time did you have to really, you know, come to terms with what was going on?
Honestly, it happened so quickly. I remember on Friday, we sort of got the news that we might have to close. We had already been forced to reduce our capacity by 50%, which was mandated, which for a busy New York restaurant was so much life and energy in it. To be forced to cut that in half, it just does something to the space. And then we heard that we would have to be forced to close altogether for dine-in service and only do delivery. And so within 2 days, we had to lay off 87 staff members so that they could get unemployment. And our proprietor, Simon Kim, is so generous that he's still giving them a weekly stipend so that they can survive. But we're constantly hustling to try and make funds by a delivery in order to provide them this. So it's within 2 days, really, we learned that we had to change our complete business model and unfortunately lay off temporarily most of our staff. It was really heartbreaking.
Yeah, it must have been just absolutely devastating. And of course, we've seen that right across the board here in Australia as well and around the world. How do you think this is going to play out? I mean, what are your thoughts about when and how long it will take us to come out of where we are? Where will the restaurant industry be?
So this is something that's very tricky, and I can really only speak to New York and our government here, but we need assistance. Not my restaurant, but all of the restaurants. You know, if this goes on any longer and if we don't have some serious assistance from the government, we'll return post-pandemic to a world without restaurants. At best, maybe a few corporate chains and McDonald's. Those are the only ones that will be able to survive. The mom-and-pop places, the ones that create this vibrant ecosystem of dining, won't be able to survive this. They just won't. So we really need the support from our government. And also, we are so appreciative to see the continued support from the community. But that can only sustain us for so long.
Mm. Well, there is some positive news from one of our finance journalists here at ABC, Alan Kohler. He does a finance report for our main ABC News Bulletin, and he loves a chart or two. And this chart ended his report on Thursday night. Let me play it for you.
And a couple of charts about these times to end with. First, global flight cancellations are up to 25%, which is surprisingly low, really. I thought it'd be more than that. And second, global restaurant bookings down 100%, which is as much as anything can fall, really. Unless it goes negative, of course, which would be where the restaurant staff ring up to book a meal at your place. It might come to that. And that's finance.
There you go. Well, there's always a place at my table for you, Victoria.
Thank you. Very appreciated.
Well, look, hopefully things will change soon. What do your colleagues in the New York industry generally think the timeline may be?
Well, everyone's really hoping for, you know, this curve to flatten within the next month or two. I think that if we were to reopen within the next couple of months, it would be feasible. I think the further we creep into the summer, the more challenging it becomes for everyone.
Mm. All right. Well, Victoria, thank you so much for joining us from New York City. I really enjoyed chatting to you. Victoria James, sommelier, restaurateur and author of the book Wine Girl, talking to us about her experiences as one of the world's youngest sommeliers.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.